This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Welcome to the Oncology Knowledge into Practice podcast, where we discuss game-changing topics in clinical oncology with leading experts in the field. In this series, we're focusing on the ever-changing treatment landscape for cancers of the hematological system. This series is supported by educational grants from Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC and Takeda, who have had no influence on the content or choice of faculty. If you'd like to check out any of the publications that we mention in this episode, there's references and links for these in the episode notes. We're your hosts, Hannah Wilgar
and Andre Grasa. Over the last 2 weeks, we looked at current and future treatment options for young and old patients with acute myeloid leukemia, or AML. For both current and future therapies, an important step in treating patients is assessing their fitness and suitability for intensive chemotherapies, and this is what we'll talk about today.
To answer our questions on this topic, we've invited Dr. Courtney DiNardo, Associate Professor in the Department of Leukemia at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. As always, to get started, we're going to spend a few minutes discussing the basics. But if you're already familiar with this topic, do feel free to skip ahead to the interview at the 5 minute mark. As we discussed in our last episode, there are several therapies in development for AML. Some of these drugs are being explored specifically in patients deemed unfit for standard chemotherapy, and as such, some current and future therapies are specifically developed for those that fall into this unfit bracket. For adults with AML, according to ESMO and NCI guidelines, the initial assessment of newly diagnosed adult AML patients should focus on the patient's fitness or suitability for standard induction and consolidation chemotherapy, as some patients may be too frail for intensive therapy. As such, there are separate induction and consolidation therapy protocols specifically for adults deemed unfit for standard chemotherapy.
So this begs the question, how does one define fitness? According to ESMO guidelines of 2020, the strongest predictor for non-relapse induction chemotherapy-related mortality are pre-existing heart, kidney, lung, or liver disease, mental illness, an ECOG performance score of 3 or above, and an age of 75 years or older. Patients with any of these presentations should be considered as possible ineligible for intensive induction and consolidation therapies.
For other older patients, their fitness for standard induction chemotherapy can be calculated using 7 clinical parameters: body temperature, age, de novo versus secondary leukemia, hemoglobin level, platelet count, fibrinogen level, and serum concentration of lactate dehydrogenase. To predict outcomes based on these predictive factors, Krug and colleagues have developed a web-based application which can be used. Similarly, another measure of fitness both for standard induction chemotherapy as well as for allogeneic stem cell transplant therapy is the HCT-specific comorbidity index score, or HCTCI score. This index generates a score and a mortality risk level based on the presence or absence of several comorbid conditions known to be associated with poor outcomes with intensive treatment.
With all of these measures and factors taken into consideration, it is important to note that the final decision concerning a patient's suitability for intensive chemotherapy lies with the patients themselves. As such, these topics should be discussed in careful consultation with the patients to reach an informed decision.
So how are patients of different fitness level treated? Patients who are considered fit receive more intensive chemotherapy regimens. However, for those that are deemed unfit or unsuitable for this, the ESMO guidelines recommend recruiting patients onto clinical trials if available. In the absence of a suitable clinical trial, the choice of therapy depends on whether or not the patient has previously been treated for a condition that often precedes AML, myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS. For those that have not progressed from MDS, their induction therapy should include a hypomethylating agent or low-dose cytarabine with venetoclax if available. For those previously treated for MDS, ESMO guidelines stipulate they should only receive a hypomethylating agent if venetoclax is available. And as an alternative, they can receive best supportive care with either 6-mercaptopurine or low-dose melphalan or hydroxycarbamide. Meanwhile, NCI guidelines recommend either a hypomethylating agent with or without venetoclax or low-dose cytarabine with or without glastegib, ivosidenib, or enasidenib. For both patient groups, they should be treated for at least 4 cycles and, in case of clinical benefit, they should continue until progression or intolerance or until their re-evaluation shows they are able to undergo consolidation allogenic hematopoietic cell transplantation.
Several trials of novel therapies also focus specifically on this unfit patient group. According to the PDQ Adult Treatment Editorial Board, although not yet approved in this setting, the IDH2 inhibitor enazenidib is an option for older or frail patients with newly diagnosed AML who are not fit for standard chemotherapy. Similarly, other novel therapies such as immunotherapy MBG453 and the NAE inhibitor pevonedistat are also being trialed specifically in the patients who are ineligible or unfit for intensive chemotherapy and or allogeneic stem cell transplantation.
As described in the PDQ guidelines for childhood AML, some prognostic factors do affect increased treatment-related mortality in children, including obesity and an infantile age. However, fitness is not a factor considered for treatment decisions. The Childhood Leukemia Clinicians Network guidelines do stipulate that treatment for childhood AML should be risk-based, but this is about risk of relapse instead of risk of treatment-related mortality, with higher-risk patients receiving more intensive therapies. A similar risk of relapse assessment is recommended in adult guidelines too, but for adults this comes secondary to fitness.
So clearly, fitness is an important factor to consider when treating AML patients, but many questions remain for clinical practice. For example, how should fitness measures be used alongside risk or relapse measures? When might fitness be considered in childhood AML? And should fitness levels be reassessed at regular intervals to check any improvements or deteriorations?
To answer some of our questions on this topic, we've invited Dr. Courtney DiNardo, Associate Professor in the Department of Leukemia at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center.
So hello, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. DiNardo, and it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Brilliant, thank you. So how does the interplay of fitness and risk of relapse work when making treatment decisions in AML?
This is one of the most important decisions that we need to make as oncologists and in collaboration with our patients, because you know the ultimate goal is of course to treat our patients well, to provide effective therapy that you know has patients you know in a long-standing remission or hopeful cure, and the treatments we have vary in intensity, and so you know the last thing we want to do as physicians is provide a toxic or high intensity therapy that actually harms our patient more than, you know, and they have an early morbidity or mortality event. And so, you know, so that interplay of fitness and treatment decisions to, you know, optimize their curability is incredibly important. We have different fitness scores that we use. None of them are perfect. The FDA has recently put together essentially a definition that has come from other different prognostic scores, which really looks at a constellation of different things. So fitness is not just an age, it's not just a number, you know, but it's, you know, our patients. Do they have a poor performance status, meaning they're not really kind of getting up and moving around throughout their day? Do they have underlying heart disease? Do they have underlying lung disease? Do they have underlying renal dysfunction or liver dysfunction? Or, you know, an age over 75 or other conditions precluding intensive chemotherapy? So it kind of puts the onus on us a little bit to be able to put all that information together into a kind of a cohesive, is our patient fit for intensive chemotherapy or not? So that is definitely the important initial decision when we're treating someone with leukemia, and it really does make a difference. For instance, you know, most patients who are, you know, young and fit without underlying, you know, medical comorbidities or complications are going to do well, and tolerate treatment regardless of what treatment you're giving them. But patients who are, you know, over the, you know, age of 60 or 70 or who have significant underlying health diseases, you know, they have a really significant, like 30% or higher risk of 30-day mortality. So that's not insignificant. And so we really want to be, you know, making treatment decisions that are in the best interest of our patient.
Great. Thank you for that. So are there any situations where you might offer unfit regimens or therapies to a patient that might normally be considered fit? And can a patient's fitness status change as treatment progresses?
Well, I will answer the second part of the question first. A patient's fitness can absolutely change as treatment continues, you know, because many of the kind of complications and comorbidities that our patients may be experiencing, you know, deconditioning related to recent infections and prolonged hospitalizations, that can be due to the underlying leukemia. So if we are so fortunate to get our patients into a nice remission and they're doing well and they're out of the hospital and they're able to regain kind of some performance status related to debility due to the leukemia, absolutely fitness can change as treatment progresses. The first part of the question is a little bit more challenging, which is, are there situations you would offer a unfit regimen to a patient that is fit? You know, and it's challenging a bit because we now have various different effective strategies, right? It was an easier answer, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago when we had intensive chemotherapy, which was potentially curative, and we had lower intensity therapy that was palliative. You know, azacitidine, decitabine, low dose cytarabine alone, you know, are effective therapies. They can improve counts for a minority of patients. They are not curative, and you know, so the goal then was to take any patient who you thought could tolerate intensive chemotherapy and give them intensive chemotherapy because that was their curative option. You know, the difference now is that we have combination therapies with small molecules, targeted therapies, venetoclax in particular in combinations is very effective, FLT3 inhibitors, IDH inhibitors in combinations as well. And so, you know, and so now the question is shifting a bit, because just because someone can tolerate intensive chemotherapy doesn't mean that they couldn't actually respond well also, for instance, to a venetoclax combination. And so, you know, there is a level of gray now that didn't exist before. And so while I don't think anyone is going to be able to confidently say we should give lower intensity combinations to fit patients, that is absolutely an area of ongoing investigation. Several clinical trials are being designed and opening to try to evaluate just that question, which is, you know, in higher risk patients who have, you know, unfavorable genomics, you know, complex cytogenetics, for instance, you know, patients who don't respond as well to intensive chemotherapy, and we know that based on decades of risk stratification, you know, patients who are not going to do as well with intensive chemotherapy because of their genomics, should those patients be prioritized for a lower intensity strategy, and would they do, you know, as well or potentially even better with a lower intensity treatment option? So that's a great question.
Perfect. Thank you for that. What other advice would you give to our listeners when determining fitness and making subsequent decisions based on that fitness in their AML patients?
I think the main advice I would give is to not treat fitness as a simple evaluation looking at your patient's age, because I think for a long time we used age as a replacement for fitness. And, you know, age really is just a number. You can have a very, you know, healthy and fit 71-year-old who is, you know, appropriate for an intensive chemotherapy regimen, and someone in their 50s who's had kind of a lifetime of chronic medical complications and, you know, is debilitated. And so I think that is probably the most important thing to consider. There are so many different ways to measure fitness, and it really at the end of the day becomes almost like, you know, an eyeball or a gestalt type test. You can, you know, you get the sense of someone who, you know, who is able to tolerate intensive chemotherapy, but there are helpful guidelines out there. I don't think any one is particularly better than the other. Some of the frailty indices that are coming from geriatric medicine are really quite helpful also. So they're not really included in, for instance, the FDA definition of fitness, but things like grip strength or the form, you know, a walk test, you know, people able to get up and down of their chair, simple things like that that are actually not so challenging to do in the clinic can actually provide a lot of insight also. And so, yeah, so I think the most important thing is to look at it with an open mind and to be kind of comprehensive in how you're thinking about fitness.
Brilliant, thank you. So although fitness is not a determining factor in childhood AML guidelines, are there situations where it would be appropriate to measure fitness in the childhood setting? For example, for obese children or infants? And if so, how might treatment differ?
That's an interesting question. And it's not one I'm particularly skilled to answer, not treating pediatric patients with leukemia, but I would suspect that, you know, it's appropriate fitness is not a primary determining factor in the initial treatment decisions, because I think there are probably very few patients who are diagnosed with leukemia who have significant underlying heart disease, lung disease, liver, kidney, you know, performance status issues in general. You know, kids are not unfit, for instance, but maybe with certain, you know, chronic conditions or you know, syndromic events, maybe that would be a different answer. But in general, I think the topic that we were mentioning where fitness should be reassessed over time because things can definitely change, that is probably where there's the most relevance for pediatric leukemia, which is, you know, patients who you know, who have complications to therapy, have a significant, you know, side effect or issue related, you know, then of course treatment needs to be reevaluated, and doses or modifications may need to be made. And so I would suspect that, you know, it's not necessarily a different treatment course at the beginning, but it's an ongoing reassessment and kind of and iterations of treatment based on how patients are responding to their therapy.
Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you again for the invitation. Take care.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode. To recap on the key points we discussed, fitness for intensive therapy in AML should be assessed not based on age alone, but based on multiple contributing factors. It is one of the most important considerations when making treatment decisions for AML patients, although with newer therapies, research is ongoing to elucidate whether some fit patients may in fact benefit from lower intensity options. So for now, that brings us to the end of this hematological cancer series. But we will be back in June to bring you the latest from the ASCO annual meeting and the EHA Congress 2021. So do come back and join us then. In the meantime, you can also find free accredited continuing medical education modules on our website, onkit.com, and you can find a link to this in the episode notes. And if you're a Twitter fan, our handle is @onkip. Thank you for listening, and until next time, all the best in your practice.